And salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here with you for the week of February 26th of the year 2016. How's it going, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages? I am Mike the Legend, who is here with you, wondering, how is it the end of February already? I just got accustomed to writing 2016 on things, on papers, and documents, and now we're into a third month, going right into a third month.
It's true.
I don't understand. Can someone just slow it down? Slow it all right down?
Yeah.
That'd be swell.
I really wish they could, but all that aside, this week I'm Dennis, the man who sometimes loves the Wayback Machine.
Ah, that old time-traveling machine of yore from the old Rocking Bullwinkle cartoon with Sherman and Mr. Peabody?
That one as well, I guess, but what I was thinking of was more from the contemporaneous age of the internet that we now live in. And have been living in for quite a while. The Wayback Machine, as presented by archive.org, I believe, is a way that we could put it.
Okay.
The Internet Wayback Machine, that is to say.
Ooh, excellent.
That crazy machine where if you ever were one, like, if there was a site that you used to like going to, but that doesn't exist anymore, you can go to the Wayback Machine and hope that it got archived at some point in the past and, you know, type the URL in and then relive the internet of however many years ago through it. But I discovered something very interesting about the Wayback Machine today, is that if something doesn't exist in the Wayback Machine, there's a little link that I never saw before, where you can just kind of opt to add the page to the Internet Archive.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So does anyone have this ability?
I believe anyone does have this ability. So if there's a site that actually might currently exist, I'll give you a little bit of context here. Today it was another terrible looking crowdfunding campaign was kind of brought to my attention by, you know, a friend of mine to work with, and he knows that on this program we like to talk about, you know, either crowdfunding campaigns that look very interesting to us or just absolutely atrocious crowdfunding campaigns that look like a train wreck. This fell into the latter category because this was some third party guy, just an everyman like you or me. I believe he actually was from somewhere in Ontario, that wrote a script for Wayne's World 3.
Good for him.
Good for him. Fan fiction works get made all the time. That's just a common thing on the internet now. But no, apparently he wrote this 23 years ago, and he's been trying to shop it around to quote-unquote Hollywood for the past 23 years, and now, thanks to the magic of the internet and crowdfunding websites that are in abundance, he set up a GoFundMe page to try to raise $2,500 to talk to an agent to help him shop his script around to try to get the movie made. Now, obviously, this is an absolutely atrocious idea. Likely, you know, won't ever get made. He might get laughed out of the room. He might even get sued or cease and desist by Mike Myers or Paramount Pictures. Any number of different people who own the rights to these characters that he doesn't own the rights to.
That's true.
But basically, I saw this crowdfunding campaign and I had a thought. I'm like, has this page been archived yet by the Internet Archive? Just for the hell of it. So I typed the URL in. Well, more correctly, I pasted the URL in.
Naturally.
And no, it wasn't. And that friendly little pop-up message came up on the page that said, hey, this page doesn't appear to be archived yet. Do you want us to archive it? With, like, you know, a little asterisk being like, you know, it's our goal to try to, you know, archive as much of the internet as possible. Data is important, blah, blah, blah. We've all heard about, you know, the Internet Archive before. Their motto is basically archive all the things. So I thought, yes. I clicked the button and went, now there's a record of it for all time. So if something happens and, like, you know, it goes, if ever this goes minorly viral and, you know, some sites I follow ever post about how this guy gets destroyed and it's too bad that the page is gone, I will be like, don't worry, everyone. I've got you covered. Here's a link to the archive. thinking ahead? Me.
Your praise and thanks can be sent to this email address. I'll accept your funds sent through PayPal as gratitude. Naturally, you will.
Yes.
Is this the first thing you've submitted to the Wayback Machine for archival purposes?
Yes. I never really thought about it before, but now I think I might start doing this for things that look like they might get taken down, that it's just like people with bad ideas. That sounds mean.
Stupid ideas.
I mean, people have bad ideas all the time. Can't really fault them for that. But if you've been trying to shop a fan fiction script around for 23 years of characters you don't own and basically you're dancing with fire. The thing about this script is he has a link to it. Just don't even bother searching it out. It's atrocious. But if you somehow, I'm just going to tell you to Google it. I'm not going to put a link anywhere on our website, thearcadeshow.com.
You don't wish to stain the webpage with that?
No, but you can do a Google search for this atrocious Wayne's World 3 crowdfunding campaign. Basically just type that into Google. Wayne's World 3 crowdfunding campaign. It'll come up.
Mm-hmm.
He has a link to the script, which is a Dropbox link to this PDF file that's 160 pages long. And I tried reading through some of the dialogue. I tried. It was so bad. So bad.
How bad was it?
It was, I'm not going to make a joke. That's how bad it was. It's just, it was bad. It was atrocious.
This script was a joke in itself.
That's the only way this would possibly work, is if a movie is made of this guy trying to get it shopped around for 23 years. That's the only way this would work. And it's like a meta joke where it's just like, he doesn't realize how bad it is. Everyone else does, and everyone keeps trying to tell him, but it's like, nope, ignoring it. Or maybe no one's told him.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe no one's told him. Maybe
they don't want to hurt his feelings.
Maybe everyone's being too nice. But it's pretty bad. It's just like rehashed but really awkwardly timed versions of much better scenes that were already in the first two Wayne's World movies. Yeah, right? Like, the thing about those movies is that, like, you know, Mike Myers and had a very heavy
Dana
hand.
Dana Carvey.
But they had a very heavy hand in creating the dialogue and the stories and everything. This doesn't have that. This is a work of fan fiction. Fan fiction doesn't necessarily always get the tone right. Fan fiction is often weird.
It can be. It can be a little disturbing. And
not even disturbing all the time. It's just sometimes it's good. Sometimes, you know, people get the tone. Sometimes you luck into someone who really gets the tone and they've just got it. But a thing like Wayne's World, I feel like those are like untouchable comedy classics. That's just my crazy opinion on the movies.
And it takes a lot of moxie to think that you're someone who can come and write something new.
Yeah.
For those characters, for those voices of them.
That would be like me being like, oh, time for Airplane 3. I'm just going to start writing the script. It's like, really? Me? Of anyone but the original people who wrote the first two? Should anyone else really try?
You know better than the Abram Zucker, you know, team?
Really? Don't think so.
Go for it. Good luck. Apparently all it takes is $2,500 to get an agent.
Yes.
And then shop it around Hollywood once you get the screenplay ready and the script. Also, how was that amount reached for this guy to determine he needs $2,500 to do the legwork and do the shopping and
like,
get it sold?
I wasn't aware that agents could just be bought like that.
No, I don't think you can just hire them for one specific purpose.
I mean, I'm not that privy in all of aspects of show business by any stretch of the imagination.
Are you privy to any aspects of that in show business?
Not that side of it.
Okay.
At all. But I've seen, you know, TV shows. I've seen, you know, TV shows that are supposed to be written like your from the context of behind the scenes kind of things where, you know, there's like, oh, agents working for blah or people talking to agents. I thought that, you know, agents and, you know, they just sort of like seek out people that they want to represent.
If you're talented enough.
If you're talented.
And if they believe you can make them money.
Yes. So honestly, can Wayne's World 3 make anyone money if it's not written by Mike Myers?
I fail to see how.
I mean, some random guy from Canada. I mean, sure, Mike Myers was a random guy from Canada at one point.
Mm-hmm.
Not anymore.
No.
He's Mike Myers from Canada. There's a distinction here.
I don't see the end point for this guy. Good on him for going through. Maybe this was just his hobby. That's something he really wanted to do and he felt satisfaction from by completing it. Okay, great. Good for him. However, I don't see how this turns out well for him.
Yeah, all I see is a cease and desist going to happen at some point, but...
And he's raised some money.
Yeah, I mean, his campaign started at the end of January of this year, and it's been going for about a month. And of his $2,500, he's currently up to about $500. So he's a fifth of the way there after a month.
Mm-hmm.
If he keeps pace, he'll have an agent in 4 more months.
Woo! Just in time for the summer screenplay shopping season.
Yes, since we all know that that's a thing.
It is. I mean, anyone who follows the daily trades, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, everyone knows that summer's a big time for selling screenplays to the big studios. That's just when they're really looking for it as they empty their shelves of movie content out into the cinemas for the summertime.
Yes, because that's exactly how that works.
It is. It is. And, you know, while everyone's busy going to the theaters to see movies, Hollywood's like, hey, all right, we need some new content just to fill in, you know, get the shelves ready for more content for next summer.
Since there's nothing else. Studios just work on one movie at a time. Like no one develops more than one movie at once. Do you think Warner Brothers develops more than one movie at once?
I wouldn't want them to because the quality would suffer.
Disney?
Certainly not.
Sony Pictures?
I think everyone knows they only do one at a time. They take a methodical approach to their movie crafting, really. Let's not say making, because you can make a wicker basket, but they craft carefully, artfully, these pieces of cinema.
To be fair, you can craft a wicker basket, too.
You can, but not with the same amount of artistry that goes into a movie.
You can do with more. I've seen it.
Where do you hang out?
You have no idea.
I want to, though. I'm intrigued.
We'll talk after about
okay,
that.
But okay. Basically, I want to go to your underground wicker basket weaving classes.
Well, we used to have a website, but it's no longer online. And we forgot to archive it on the Internet Archive. So, which is why, bringing us back to the original point of why the Wayback Machine is so good, you know, for posterity's sake anyways, if there was ever a website, if you want to make sure a website gets archived, by all means do it.
Website, web page, something you find online on the internet that you think is worth preserving for the ages. Either so you can enjoy it later on down the road or everyone can enjoy it later on down the road and just make sure it's still there.
Yes.
To enjoy in future.
Indeed.
So we'll post a link to the Wayback Machine on our website, TheArcadeShow.com. We won't post a link to the Wayne's World 3 thing, Patreon, GoFundMe page, crowdfunding page.
Yes, it's a GoFundMe page, I believe it is, but, yeah.
It's a thing that exists in the world and we have to accept that.
Yep.
But speaking of movies and sequels, we'll get into our first ludicrous leadoff this week, talking about a movie that is going to be a sequel that is going to be a very necessary sequel. I'd say. And
yep.
A sequel to a film from the 70s.
Yeah. Classic film from 1975 starring... Actually, I always like to put it this way. It's a movie where David Carradine outbuild Sylvester Stallone. I don't think Sylvester Stallone was even in the principal, like listed as like even close to being top billed cast in this movie.
I don't think so. He was a supporting role.
Yes, he was a supporting role way before Rocky. Well, not way before Rocky, a couple of years before Rocky, but still before he broke out as a superstar.
Mm-hmm.
He was in it. David Carradine is the main character in this movie, along with, you know, a few other, you know, interesting 70s characters. But it was a movie set in a very weird dystopian future that in many ways seems like it could be reality now, if reality was just a little bit off to the left by, well, one of my favorite, you know, B-movie directors of the 1970s, 80s, 90s, even up until now, he's still going, thankfully. The man was Roger Corman, is Roger Corman, I should say. And the movie is Death Race 2000.
Yes, a film set a mere 25 years in the future, doing that typical 70s thing of setting, if it's a futuristic film or a film set in a future date, setting it. So it's really close. So people can...
It's 35 years in the future.
At some point, still see it. Perhaps live to tell the tale and see what it turned out to and compare it to the future that was envisioned in that film.
Yeah. No, they didn't go anywhere near as fanciful as even Back to the Future did with some of their technology or choices of how things would have progressed.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why it's so amusing that, like, this is supposed to be the year 2000. It still looks like 1975. It's not really that much further beyond 1975. But yeah, anyways, it took place 35 years in the future, and then that was that. And then, you know, like a few years ago, we saw a remake that was just like a weird gritty reboot, and it sort of missed the entire point, in my opinion, of what the movie was.
Yeah, they turned it into a balls-out action movie.
Jason Statham in it.
Just called Death Race.
Yes.
With a focus on the vehicular combat, vehicular action and explosions, and trying to make it a more gritty, more violent form of Fast and the Furious, I suppose.
Yeah, while totally missing the cartoonish contest aspect of the original movie with like the over-the-top outrageous characters.
Which I feel we should fill in some of the listeners as to what Death Race 2000 was about, because there's a good chance they might not have seen it and might not be up on what it was all about.
That's true.
So Death Race 2000, as we said, was set in a dystopian future, and it's kind of like Cannonball Run mixed with Grand Theft Auto, if you will.
Yeah.
It's a cross-country race across America, but killing of pedestrians and any sort of other homicidal acts
basically
gets you points.
Did you ever play Carmageddon, the video game? If you've played Carmageddon, Carmageddon was very much inspired by Death Race 2000.
Mm-hmm.
To the T, everything about it was very Death Race 2000. The cartoonish, over-the-top, everything. But the original Death Race 2000 sort of took a more political bent, because it was in the same way that Running Man was sort of like, there was like Big Brother kind of controlled media, and, you know, you saw what they wanted you to see, and there was one big company that sort of, one or two big companies that kind of ruled the world through money. Weird. Never would have thought never would have saw that one coming.
Thank God that hasn't happened.
Yeah, right. But, yeah, so there's like a resistance group and basically like a series of ludicrous characters, including, you know, there's like a guy who's supposed to be like an ancient Roman looking guy who's called Nero the Hero. there's a I don't even know if you'd call it a neo-Nazi. It's a guy that's basically a Nazi from the looks like he's a Nazi from the 1940s, and he's called Herman the German. And his lady friend was Matilda the Hun. I'm sorry.
Maintain your composure.
I have to maintain
my composure. We're professionals here.
Yes. And a lady who was like, looked like, well, whose name was Cleopatra. You fill in that blank. And David Carradine was Frankenstein, who was like a typical 70s type weird mysterious character where he just had a cape and a leather outfit, basically, including a full gimp mask for some reason. Don't read too much into that regarding his later life. yeah, it was a crazy movie. And you might be thinking, why are you talking about Death Race 2000? Okay, we get it. Death Race 2000 was a crazy movie from 1975. Mm-hmm. Takes place 35 years in the future. It's crazy. What is this, the blast from the past already? No, but it has been the blast from the past before.
It has.
And we would recommend watching it. It's worth it. It's a fun movie. But, you know, some of us were kind of disappointed in 2008 when they made a remake and not a sequel. And even still, if they made a sequel, why would we want a big budget, crazy Hollywood sequel? That completely ruins the whole original feeling of the movie from 1975.
It does. The idea is that it's a lower budget fare, but big on social commentary.
Yeah.
And we're talking about it for the good reason that last week, the news came out that there's going to be an actual authentic sequel to Death Race 2000 from 1975.
Yes.
It's going to be called Death Race 2050.
Yes. Noting how it's approximately 35 years in the future from now, I mean 34, but still,
mm-hmm.
It's a nice round number, so I can't blame them for not wanting to go Death Race 2051. Now, you might be thinking, great, so what is this, just some trash made by someone who just got the license? Well, no. It's way better than that.
It is being produced by legendary B-movie producer, director, and all-around underappreciated film icon, Roger Corman.
Yes.
The original man behind Death Race 2000.
And you might be thinking, well, David Carradine's dead. How can they possibly get another ridiculous lead that could possibly live up to David Carradine from his 1975 performance as Frankenstein?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
They got the perfect man.
They have the absolute perfect man, a man who was around back then making equally crazy movies,
mm-hmm.
and who's still around, maybe not making as crazy movies anymore, but this might be a return to form for him, because they got Malcolm McDowell himself to play a character called the Chairman.
The Chairman of, I believe, whatever multinational, omnipotent, omnipresent global corporation that exists in 2050 that is likely putting on the death race.
Yes. Which is like a slight callback to the original death race, where it wasn't the chairman, but it was Mr. President. But yes, there still will be a Frankenstein, unfortunately not played by David Carradine, but this time played by Manu Bennett. The big guy from New Zealand, who you may have seen from Spartacus or Arrow.
Yeah,
or a few other things.
Yeah, on Arrow he played Slade Wilson, Deathstroke, who was the main villain in season one, made appearances in season two as well on the show Arrow. So, yes, a respectable cast, and nary a Jason Statham to be had in this one. Or I believe Tyrese Gibson was also in that 2008 remake.
Yep, none of that.
No, and even better, this wasn't just an announcement that the film is happening and there's still a whole production ramp up to it. No, it's the fact that it's happening and they're filming now, and yep. It's coming out this year.
Yep. Principal photography is already happening in Peru, of all places. The crappy thing is that there's not going to be a theatrical release, but in many ways, that doesn't matter. I'm fine with that. A movie like this, if it means getting it made faster and actually getting made and distributed, I'm okay with it going direct to Blu-ray.
I think that maintains some of its underground credibility, too, if it does not receive a big theatrical release.
Oh, exactly. I mean, it's like the classic trauma films of the days of gone by. I mean, you would have never seen something like, you know, like any of the classic trauma movies.
Oh God, no.
In any sort of like major theater, with the possible exception of maybe the Toxic Avenger if you're really lucky, but no, I mean, or same thing for most Roger Corman movies as well. They were more like B movies that you'd see at a drive-in, but we don't have drive-ins anymore, so oh well.
We don't know exactly when Death Race 2050 is coming out this year, but it will be coming out on video on demand, straight to home video, Blu-ray, that kind of thing. And in the press release stating that production has started on Death Race 2050, Roger Corman submitted a quote, and in there he said, quote, "This is an amazing opportunity for me and millions of Death Race 2000 fans to experience the intensity, thrills, and dark humor of the original, fueled by a terrific young cast, spectacular vehicles, and side-splitting action." Literally. Roger Corman's Death Race 2050 puts the pedal to the metal to bring this enduring franchise to a whole new level, end quote.
And in addition to that, they also provided a synopsis of this 2050.
Excellent.
Which I will read right now to the best of my abilities.
Oh, those are somewhat in question.
Screw you. I will just continue reading now. So, and I quote, "In the not-too-distant future, America is controlled by an all-powerful corporate government that keeps the masses placated with violent virtual reality entertainment. The event of the year is the Death Race, where a motley assortment of drivers compete in a cross-country road race, scoring points for running down pedestrians and killing each other. The reigning champion and popular favorite is half-man, half-machine Frankenstein, but little does he know he's taken on a rebel spy as his co-pilot."
Well, congratulations on getting through it.
Yep. I managed.
Yeah, well done. You did not stutter, stammer, stumble at all.
I stumbled a little bit at the end, but that's fine.
You were far enough along. I was going to let it slide.
But yeah, so it sounds...
See, that synopsis to me just sounds like Wacky Races, the old Hanna-Barbera cartoon, but just a shit ton more violent.
Yes, just like the original Death Race 2000.
I want to see this now.
I really hope some of the original people who were involved in the movie might make some cameos. I know it's really unlikely, but if they could get Sylvester Stallone smashing a violin, that would be great.
That's a big ask.
That's a huge ask. I don't think he would ever do that. I mean, this is a direct to deep, like, Blu-ray thing. I don't think they could afford him.
And he is nominated for an Academy Award, so he might want to maintain whatever shred of newfound acting respectability he has.
Yeah. I understand. I don't think it's going to happen. It's just a nice pipe dream I have.
Oh, it certainly is, and I'm just going to let you hold on to that.
Yep.
But we'll see when the film comes out later this year. When there's an official release date, we will let you know because you need to watch it. Just yes. Like you need to watch the original.
Yes.
In order to appreciate it. And speaking of things from days gone by, we spoke last week of the Internet Archive archiving a whole bunch of Windows 3.1 programs, games, and other things from the early 90s era of Windows computing.
Yep. And you know, they're all online to play. You can play them right in your browser thanks to, you know, I guess it's a browser plugin for to play through DOSBox. Mm-hmm. DOSBox is sort of like a popular emulation program to emulate an old DOS environment, so you can run your old, you know, whatever DOS games you have disk images for, because I highly doubt you have a floppy drive in your computer anymore. Especially if you have like a newer laptop. Chances are you might not even have an optical drive.
There's a very good chance of that.
And yeah, so it's a fun little bit of emulation, but you know, actually like running it yourself is a pain. So it's nice that, you know, some people make these websites that just do all the work for you and mm-hmm. you don't have to install anything special. It's just there on the website. But still, you know, it's a lot of these things require browser plugins. And because, I don't know, this is maybe it's just me as a web developer myself. I like to kind of like get behind the hood of how some of these things work. And I'm really quite impressed when they do things that can just be run natively in the browser with no plugins using well, the language of the web, as they call it, JavaScript. And, you know, JavaScript technology's come along quite a ways in the last 10 years or so. Really, in the last 5 years, there's been lots of crazy advances made where people have made tools to even port C++ and C libraries to be run in your web browser just natively, which is mind-blowing because web browsers are that good now and fast, and computers are that capable.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, once someone kind of cracked the ability to write a computer, essentially, like a emulated computer in your browser, all of a sudden the floodgates kind of opened up. And this past week, we came across a very interesting link on Gizmodo, one of the tech blogs that we like to often reference stories from because they point very interesting things out sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a website called copy.sh where they have a bunch of emulators for various computers, and the most notable of which that caught our eye was a Windows 98 emulator running directly in your browser. So
think about that for a minute.
Think about that for a second. A website that's a self-contained website, you just enter the URL and hit enter,
mm-hmm.
and there's a complete emulated setup of Windows 98 directly on the website, right there.
So the thing that ran your computer, you know, many years ago, probably in your teenage years?
Yes.
You can run that now in a web browser.
Yes. There's an entirely sandboxed environment of what would have been an entire computer that was a big white tower, you know, underneath, you know, a desk somewhere, likely in your dad's office,
mm-hmm.
or his home office or whatever, you know, in your parents' home when you were, you know, a lot younger, or maybe you were the dad and you're just an older guy listening to our program. That's cool too. That's fine.
We welcome everyone.
We welcome everyone. We're not going to judge, but just think about that for a second. All of that entire thing can now be emulated, sandboxed in a website. Just a whole website could just be served up in your web browser that is a Windows 98 environment.
You need nothing physical for it.
Yes.
No CD, there's no floppy drive, there's no A drive attachment, nothing. Nothing at all to make this operate. It just goes.
I'd like to just point out that the Windows IE, I think it was IE4, every time I tried to open it up and try to go to any website, it would crash immediately, which cracked me up quite a bit. I mean, I tried typing facebook.com inside that web browser and it just crashed. It just...
No, not happening.
No, just died right away. It's like, well, I guess I understand.
Oh God. If only you had tried to pull up the old and now I'm sure it's been archived website for Space Jam.
Or Dole Camp 96.
Or Dole Camp 96.
Which is still up. It's still legitimately up. Someone is still paying to keep that website running. Don't need to go to the Internet Archive for that. It's just up and being served still. The campaign page for Bob Dole and Kemp. I don't remember his first name.
Jack Kemp? John Kemp?
Let's go with that. Sure, John Kemp.
From the 1996 U.S. presidential election.
Yes, the election from 20 years ago.
That may have been a website that this emulated version of Windows Internet Explorer 4 could actually have pulled up.
Yes, because this would have been a relevant website back then.
Well within the technical specifications of what Windows 98 could handle.
Yes.
Or a machine running Windows 98 could handle.
Yes, but basically the entire machine is now running inside your web browser. Just think about that for a second.
And you can even play Minesweeper with it.
Yep.
That's a little just mind-boggling. I believe it was last week when we were talking about Windows 3.1 programs being archived when you made the comment that, you know, just based on the technological advances and your phone, and if you were to show your phone now to 10-year-old you, your mind would be blown.
Yep.
And now to think this, you can pull up just, on a web page.
Yeah.
An entire computer of what you probably had in your parents' house at the time.
Yeah, like, I think the idea of, like, an entire sandbox computer environment in and of itself would have been hard to grasp, let alone an entire sandbox computer environment embedded on a web page that you run entirely from within the session of that one web page. It's not touching any other part of your computer. Nothing.
No, nope.
Like, you can't get a virus or anything from it because it's just within the web page. It's completely fine. Like, sure, you can get a virus in that computer and ruin that computer, but guess what? You can also just reload the web page and it's fine again. So there's that.
And again, back then, your connection to the internet likely would have been on dial-up, 56K.
Yes, 56K.
To pull up a web page.
Yep.
As you would have to sit there and be patient as it would slowly load from the top down.
Yes, all of the different images, assets, everything. If there was a big image, it would hinder the website loading, but you'd have to wait. Because if it was a site you wanted to see, well, you wait.
That's what you just had to do.
Yep.
And now, on an internet page, you can pull up an entire computer. The computer you would have used to pull up that, you know, image back in really 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Just putting that out there, mind-boggling.
Yep.
Though not surprising, but just to think of it and frame it in this context that, again, an entire computer you could have used in whatever age 20 years ago is now just a website.
Yep. It's these kind of weird advances that we've made that are super advanced compared to things that we've seen in, like, you know, the movies and everything of, like, the 70s and 80s. Yet we still don't have flying cars or hoverboards.
Well, we have things called hoverboards, yeah, but
we know we don't actually have hoverboards. I mean, unless
they're more like flame boards.
Oh, no, but
because they catch fire.
Yeah, I got
that. Yeah,
but yeah, I mean, I also understand how impractical flying cars actually would be. It's probably a good thing we don't have them. I'm glad we have, like, you know, ABS and technology like that now instead. A little safer. But yeah, so just a very interesting bit of food for thought. And of course, the link to that will be on our website, thearcadeshow.com. So check it out. It's very weird just to kind of think about that we can do stuff like that now.
Yeah, it's one thing to think that your phone is just an entire computer that used to be, you know, a huge PC tower, but now it's the thing in your hand is a lot more powerful and a lot smaller. But to think that the entire system of what you used to use can now just be shrunk even further down in size to a web page is...
Yeah. Everything can just be done through code now.
Yep. Yeah, essentially. This is the just part I have a hard time grasping for the future we now live in, and what comes next? I don't know.
Just be thankful you're not a web developer, because you have to think about these things all the time. Like, oh, now this is the thing that we have to think about. Okay. I guess I'll read another book really quickly and try to do something with this. Okay.
Well, while you're doing that, some other people out there in the world are working to put together trailers to promote upcoming games. One of those upcoming games that received a trailer recently was Uncharted 4: A Thief's End. And we're talking about it because you might have heard this week that...
This is something, this came across the radar for me, I laughed and I had no idea how something like this could have happened. And it's to the point where I thought, this had to have been done on purpose. They had to have done this on purpose. How could they possibly make a mistake like this otherwise?
If you don't know the mistake Dennis is referencing there, well, in a trailer released just this week, but subsequently taken down, edited, and then reposted, but when it was first initially launched on YouTube, the trailer for Uncharted 4: A Thief's End contained a painting, or an image that was made to look like a painting above a fireplace on a mantle.
Yeah, it was a framed piece of art that was...
Looked like some kind of, like, beach cove scene.
Yeah, you know, it's like a ship or something, just in the cove somewhere.
Yeah, some sand or rock formation. Looks like some nondescript thing, some nondescript, maybe tropical image, but it turns out that was a not-so-nondescript tropical image, because it was actually an art asset that was used in another game.
It was a concept art for Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag. Someone brought up the website that had all the concept art on it, and they were like, there, that's the one. Image 4 on this gallery right here that's out in the open. There it is. You just use that. How could you? This is from another major video game.
A game that came out in 2013.
3 years ago. Not even that long ago.
Nope.
It's not like, it's like some lost.
It's not.
It would actually be even worse if it was just a concept art from some unknown game from like 10 years ago. That would have been even more underhanded, I think, if that was the case. Which is why this is so weird and hilarious to me, because it's like, this is a major AAA title that they basically just stole an art asset from.
The wrongly used art asset was initially pointed out by Amar Azeza, who's the head of content for the Assassin's Creed franchise at the Ubisoft Montreal studio, and apologize if I butchered the pronunciation of the last name there. That tends to happen. Not on purpose, though. But when he took to Twitter and pointed out not just that the artwork from Assassin's Creed 4 had been used, but the specific time in the video when you could see it. And people then were curious and double-checked and did a quick Google search with the image in question, and it returned nothing but results for Assassin's Creed 4.
Yep.
And turns out, holy crap, yes, this is actually from Assassin's Creed 4.
Yeah. Like his specific tweet, actually, he said, wow, Uncharted 4 using one of AC4's artwork in their trailer. I get the thief title now. Then he said LOL at 136. So that's that.
So at least it didn't seem like Ubisoft was terribly upset, perhaps a bit more confused, like yeah, the rest of the internet was.
Like, what the, like, was this a subtle nod? Was this supposed to be a subtle nod to Assassin's Creed? If so, why? Why? I don't understand. Like, they have talented artists working at Naughty Dog. I mean, clearly, I mean, have you seen how the Assassin, have you seen how the Uncharted games look? They look really nice.
They do.
They could have just taken a screenshot from some other, like, Uncharted game.
Some unreleased art asset image could have been used.
It wouldn't have even have to have been unreleased. They could have just literally print screen and any of the games at any time. And it would have probably made a decent looking picture for this in this, like, it would have been like a strange meta thing, but who knows? They could have even taken a screenshot from one of the other trailers for one of the Uncharted games. Or for this Uncharted game. Who knows? Mm-hmm. I'm sure they could have scrounged together some sort of, like, classy-looking cove. But nope. I really don't understand how this could have possibly happened.
But the image was, I guess, brought to Naughty Dog's attention, which it couldn't not have been. It was going to get back to them, and Sony initially didn't reply to these comments, but I guess Naughty Dog later in the day took down the video and then posted a message on their website in regards to this kerfuffle, saying, quote, in our eagerness to get the story trailer out, we made a regrettable mistake and didn't thoroughly vet the artwork used for an in-game painting. We've already updated the trailer. We hold all artistry in high regard and take full responsibility for having allowed this to happen. We want to sincerely apologize to everyone at Ubisoft, the Assassin's Creed team, the original artist, and our fans. End quote. Because most of all, they let down their fans. Those are the people most hurt by this. Their fans.
I think perhaps the original artist is the person most hurt by this. You know, that original artist whose name still remains unknown, that they didn't point out at all. I don't know the guy's name. I mean, I'm sure I could look for it, but why should I have to do that work as a third-party person? I should just know who the guy's name is, right? I'd be a little bit mad if I was that artist.
You'd think.
I mean, sure, they mentioned Ubisoft and Assassin's Creed, but is that enough? Kind of sucks for the artists.
A little bit, yeah, because it makes it sound and come across as if the image itself is owned by Ubisoft. It was done by Ubisoft, the corporation.
Yes, the corporation just spat out an image somehow.
Through magic.
Yeah, through magic. Through the means of corporate synergy, we've produced this art asset.
And it's because of the vertical integration of Ubisoft that they were to spit out this one Cove-based art asset.
Yes.
Synergizing their Cove department and their art department.
While trying to maintain a flat structure, they have managed to combine the think tank of one synergized group to the non-redundancy of another group. Anyways, we can
and harmonize the two of them.
Yes, harmonize the two in perfect harmony. But we could go on and on with this, but we won't. All we have to say is this is hilarious, and I don't even know how this could have possibly happened other than someone trying to play a joke.
Or someone just needing an art asset and did a quick Google search. I don't know.
For Assassin's Creed Cove?
Assassin's Creed 4, Cove art. Damn, I've always loved that Cove art from Assassin's Creed 4. Man, maybe it's like a Beatles Beach Boys thing, you know, between Naughty Dog and Ubisoft Montreal.
Maybe.
The Cove art was always so much better for Assassin's Creed 4 and from Ubisoft. Just Naughty Dog's like, damn, we just can't compare.
So they're going to end up shelving, what, the fourth Uncharted game for 35 years?
Yes, and just everyone's going to go on mental breakdown for very long. They will not leave their bedrooms.
And then they're going to, like, you know, build a sandbox somewhere and then just make a Crash Bandicoot game while drinking a lot of alcohol and clearly having some problems that they're not addressing properly.
They're fine. The problem is with you.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
They don't know what the problem is. Maybe you have the problem. Maybe you have the problem.
Yes.
Maybe it's you who can't admit the problem.
Sure. Anyways.
But a problem some people out there in the world are going to be having in April is scrounging up enough coins and pennies and dollaroos to pay for the HTC Vive, which just last weekend at the Mobile World Congress announced a release date and pricing details for its the release of the virtual reality headset, as it's set to come out in April, is when it will actually be shipping. Pre-orders are set to launch at the end of the month on Leap Day. That's February 29th at 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, 9 a.m. Central Standard Time, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I don't know what it is in Greenwich Mean Time, nor do I care. I'm not over there. I worry about Central Time.
Let's just call it zero.
0 hour?
Yes. GMT zero. Done. That's not the actual time, but that's fine.
I'm pretty sure that's a sign of the apocalypse if 0 hour has happened.
Well, I mean, like, midnight, the first hour. Oh,
that's what we're talking about.
Yes. Or in 24 hour time, zero. Not one.
I just prefer, I enjoy calling it 0 hour.
The 0 hour, end of days, beginning of days.
Get to the chopper!
We have to get out of here! Oh shit! But yes, so.
Now I just have a hankering to watch those John and Al,
the John and Al, Kaplan.
Yes.
Arnold Schwarzenegger musicals.
Yes.
Which, haven't really mentioned them in a while, but they're totally worth watching. Especially, like, you know.
Commando is amazing.
The musical. Conan the Barbarian the musical. Anyways, there's a bunch of them, but yes.
Anyway, we're talking
back about to the HTC Vive.
HTC Vive, yes, one of the first, virtual reality headsets to come out this year. Oculus Rift will get a head start when it comes out in March. And actually comes out at a lower price point. The Oculus Rift will retail for $600, which will be $200 less than what the HTC Vive is going to cost you in April. Here's the difference. The Oculus Rift does not come with any controllers. The HTC Vive does.
Yeah, as well as Well, the consumer edition of Vive will come with the headset, along with two wireless controllers, two base stations, a link box to connect to your PC, and a pair of Vive earbuds.
Ooh.
So there's more value there. I mean, there's a lot of different things. Whereas, like, if you were to buy comparable items for the Oculus piecemeal, you're likely going to be spending more than that. Which is the argument that Dan O'Brien, who's the virtual reality VP over at HTC, is trying to make.
And I think he's got a point there, too.
Yeah.
In addition to that, the HTC Vive is also going to ship with two free games to come across and show why you want the HTC Vive and demonstrate its technical capabilities. It will be coming with Fantastic Contraption and Job Simulator, the game that simulates jobs that people used to have before robots came along and took over all the jobs.
Yes. We've talked about it briefly on this program before in the past, and it sounds hilarious.
Apparently, there's going to be even more games announced for the HTC Vive at the Game Developers Conference in March. It was also noted, actually, that Steam will be a platform for you to download games onto the Vive itself.
Yeah, so, I mean, where there are computer games, there is Steam.
Or
Steam is definitely a delivery mechanism that you will be able to count on for any sort of PC-related device.
You certainly will, excuse me. Not the games won't go onto the HTC Vive itself because you'll have to connect it to a strong enough and powerful enough computer.
Yeah, essentially this is just like a monitor that you strap to your head.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I get it. But, yeah.
So you'll need a few dollars for that, just like you'll need a few dollars if you wish to pony up and contribute to a new crowdfunding campaign, as we talk about crowdfunding again on this program, that was launched to create a game based on two movie characters that you wouldn't think would be suitable for a video game.
I mean, like, they're iconic movie characters at this point, even though they haven't really been in a movie proper for, what, 15 years now?
Since, I think it's less than that. Maybe around 10 for Clerks 2.
Oh, that's right. But yes, the characters we're obviously speaking of are Jay and Silent Bob, Jason Mewes, and Kevin Smith's perennial stoners that were a staple of the View Askew universe for a number of years and made appearances in all of Kevin Smith's early movies.
Mm-hmm. Clerks, Small Rats, Chasing Amy, Dogma.
Yeah. Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Yes, that was supposed to be
the last one until they showed up again in Clerks 2. And I don't think they've been in another one since then.
I don't think so either.
But yeah. Basically, yeah, they launched a crowdfunding campaign for a Jay and Silent Bob video game where it's going to be called Chronic Blunt Punch. And it's not on Kickstarter or anything. The reason why this is interesting is because I believe it's like the first non-Tim Schafer related endeavor to be launched on Fig.
It is. It's one of the first ones. I believe Fig had two campaigns before Tim Schafer launched the campaign for Psychonauts 2 earlier this year. But those were of lesser notoriety, and then Tim Schafer's, and then we now have the Kevin Smith campaign for Jay and Silent Bob Chronic Blunt Punch, which I'm sure that's going to have an easy time getting through whatever censoring bodies.
Yeah, why not?
Just the name. Maybe some people would deem objectionable.
Well, who would deem it objectionable if it's just released through for the crowdfunding people?
Parents. We have to worry about the kids.
I don't think that Kevin Smith is afraid of an 18-plus rating. Just putting that out there. But
fair enough.
Jay and Silent Bob Chronic Blunt Punch, they're asking for $400,000, and it's supposed to be a co-op side-scrolling brawler, I guess, along the lines of like a River City Ransom classic kind of game. But the kick is that in addition to punching and kicking, you can also do convo combos.
Convo combos?
Yes, because, you know, Kevin Smith is known for his words that he writes the characters to say in great succession.
Yes, he is very verbose in his writing. Very verbose.
Yeah, so apparently this convo combo mode has players throwing out yo mama-like insults. And, yeah, very classic Jay and Silent Bob type premise where the story is apparently you are Jay and Silent Bob traveling to a big shopping mall to find out what happened to the missing customers, likely while imbibing in
their product.
Their product that they are known for imbibing in.
Yes, you know, to make sure it's of a high quality and that it's worth selling.
Yes. That's not written here, but we've all seen enough Kevin Smith movies to know what Jay and Silent Bob are all about.
Yeah, they're not selling Girl Guide cookies.
No. Well, maybe. Maybe after, because, you know, the munchies and such.
This is true. The game is being developed by Interbang Entertainment, who are working on this alongside Kevin Smith and bringing the Jason Mewes characters to life. And we'll see how it all turns out. As of a few days, or a few days into this campaign, they might make it. They still have a good month left in the campaign, as I think they gave themselves about 40 days to try and achieve the goal, and the funding can be done through either people seeking normal backer rewards like magnets, stickers, the game, you know, tote bags, t-shirts, standard crowdfunding campaign rewards, or investment rewards as well, or not rewards, excuse me, options, so you can become an actual stakeholder in the game.
Yeah.
Because that's something you can do through the FIG platform that you can't do on Kickstarter.
Yeah. So I guess just for exact numbers here, there's 34 days left. They're asking for $400,000. They've currently garnered 923 backers, and those 923 backers have put forward almost $105,000.
Okay.
So they're getting there. They're about a quarter of the way there, three quarters of the way left to go. If they had about 40 days to do it, they're doing a little bit better than one quarter per week. Mm-hmm. So that's good.
It bodes well for them. And
hopefully they can, like, you know, maybe have a couple of pushes to try to gain a bit more money, but yeah, so.
And if this project does reach its funding goal, if it does successfully launch, then the developers will plan to launch it on the PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and PC.
Yeah.
Again, assuming it is able to launch successfully and doesn't encounter any sort of problems, delays, dilemmas that we've seen so many crowdfunded video games encounter. Be it Mighty Number 9, be it, oh, I don't know, the whole saga with Tim Schafer, Double Fine Adventure, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. There's, I mean, or even just like not quite getting what you paid for kind of buyer beware stuff. Like if we talk about the Don Bluth, like the Dragon Lair.
Oh yeah, the movie. Animatic to shop to, show to movie studio heads to try and entice them into, you know, then funding an actual movie. Or other things like the Medora campaign that was successfully funded, but asking for not nearly enough money, and the people behind it kind of knew that.
Yeah. Which is definitely not okay.
Certainly not.
So in case you're not sure about Interbang Entertainment, they have done Super Combo Man in the past, so they're not entirely new to video games, but I've never heard of that game before. I'm just going to put that out there. But yeah, so maybe in time, once this game's released, maybe it'll go over well with the critics. Maybe by this time next year, we'll have seen them maybe win some DICE awards. You know, the DICE awards, that whole thing that recently happened this year.
Indeed, the annual industry, awards, event that happens every year where the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences will honor game developers and individual games. You know, it's the industry honoring itself as opposed to some contrived made-for-TV event or some sort of other external journalist-driven event. It's the industry honoring itself and themselves.
It's like the Academy Awards for video games.
Yeah, I think that's probably the fairest way to put it. And the event was held last weekend in Los Angeles, I believe it was. And so we'll just go through some of the big award winners of the night in some of the major categories. And in contrast to Jeff Keighley's Game Awards, from December, it was not Witcher 3 that won the Game of the Year title.
No, Fallout 4 won this time for this one, which, okay, I'm not that surprised. I mean, I guess as an industry, Fallout 4, like for the industry in general, Fallout 4 probably had the most buzz out of any of the games. I don't know what their criteria for Game of the Year would be, but it probably would have been a toss-up at least between Witcher 3 and Fallout 4. Arguably, it would have been a toss-up between any of the things nominated. Mm-hmm. They were all very worthy, but I'm not surprised that Fallout 4 is the winner in this case.
Other games nominated for Game of the Year at the DICE Awards were Bloodborne, Ori and the Blind Forest, and Rise of the Tomb Raider. But not only was Fallout 4 named Game of the Year, it also won the award for Outstanding Achievement in Game Direction, beating out Life is Strange, Undertale, the hit indie game darling, and also beat out Witcher 3 and Rise of the Tomb Raider.
Now, I'm a little bit surprised by that. I mean, having played both, I haven't played either to completion, but I've played both The Witcher 3 and I've played Fallout 4. And honestly, like, I think in terms of like just acting, storytelling, and just scenes staging and everything, Witcher 3 was just, I think it was better than Fallout 4. Maybe not in terms of like depth of gameplay necessarily, or like size of the world or anything like that, or amount of dialogue perhaps, but I feel like The Witcher 3 characters felt like better characters. I don't know if that factors into what they were saying for game direction in general. I don't know. Again, I don't really know what the criteria for a lot of these things are, but yeah, Fallout 4 won both of the big categories.
It did. Another big one was Adventure Game of the Year, which was handed to Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain, which in an interesting twist from December, Konami was not present to accept the award.
No.
If you recall back to the Game Awards a couple months ago, when Metal Gear Solid 5 won the Best Action Adventure Game category on that event, on the Jeff Keighley Show, Hideo Kojima was supposed to be there to accept the award, but however, he was barred by Konami's lawyers, and eventually Kiefer Sutherland went up to accept the award, and it seemed very weird, and that's when afterwards Jeff Keighley came on and said that they spoke to Hideo Kojima. They wanted Hideo Kojima there. Hideo Kojima could not be there because lawyers.
Yeah. But this time,
Hideo Kojima was there not to accept the award because he has no ties to Metal Gear Solid anymore.
That's right.
But he was there actually to be inducted into the DICE or Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences Hall of Fame. And he was inducted by Guillermo del Toro.
Which is an awesome, nice, you know, one final screw you to Konami. Pretty much in general.
And when Hideo Kojima took the stage to give his spiel and accept his honor of being inducted into the Hall of Fame, the whole room gave him a standing ovation.
Which sounds about right.
Which had to feel really good if you're Hideo Kojima.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure Hideo Kojima is not hurting for money. I'm sure Hideo Kojima is not, you know, at a loss for anyone wanting to work with him or anything.
Certainly not.
But for all the crap he went through in a very public way with Konami, it must be good to just finally have all of that behind him and just basically see that people don't associate him with all of that nonsense, particularly, that is now behind him.
And it's his peers in the game development community who understood the crap he was going through.
Oh, yeah.
And could empathize, but ultimately very little they could do in their own rights.
Yeah.
To honor him and say, thank you. It's almost as if they were saying it's okay. And I'm sure for him, just a great moment of catharsis.
Yeah.
For that to be done and over with. Couple other awards worth mentioning. The awards for Outstanding Achievement in Animation and the Award for Outstanding Achievement in Art Direction were handed out to the same game. Ori and the Blind Forest took those home.
And what I think is interesting is the mobile game of the year. That one I actually definitely don't disagree with. Fallout Shelter won that one. That was the sort of like the darling that people who aren't even really into Fallout and stuff got into, because it's just a fun little resource management game on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, that one beat out Lara Croft Go. Another one that would look pretty interesting as well, the Pac-Man 256, as well as the Room 3 and Dominations.
Indeed. Outstanding Achievement in Story went to Witcher 3 Wild Hunt.
I totally agree with that.
Beating out Rise of the Tomb Raider, Tales from the Borderlands, Fallout 4, and, if you can believe it, Her Story.
Which, I honestly think it looked like it would have been it would have been toss out between that and Witcher 3.
And also in another category that Her Story was nominated in, Outstanding Achievement in Character, it lost that category as well. Instead, that award went to Rise of the Tomb Raider for the character of Lara Croft.
Very interesting.
So
I mean, Lara Croft's not a new character, but I guess that people must like the new spin that they've been putting on her.
The more realistic, more contemporary approach to a Lara Croft character.
Because, I mean, let's face it, the original Lara Croft is not really a character. It's just, it's a boobs delivery mechanism is all it was, honestly. Which, that's not really a character. That's just, you know, something clearly pandering to 14-year-old boys going through puberty.
And yes, and also the games kind of made her, in a way, almost to be like a superhero.
Yeah,
in
a very weird superhero.
Wild, over-the-top adventures, whereas the new Lara Croft character is a lot more based in reality. Just of very fictional reality.
Yeah.
But something that feels not as over the top as what some of the previous generation of Lara Croft games reach. And one last award I wanted to mention was the award for Outstanding Achievement in Game Design, which is a pretty big one as well. Nominated in this category was Fallout 4, Her Story, Lara Croft Go, Massive Chalice, and Witcher 3 Wild Hunt, with the award ultimately going to Witcher 3 Wild Hunt.
And I can see that.
Those are all very worthy games, actually.
Yeah.
And Witcher 3 Wild Hunt taking it home. So even though it didn't win the biggest game categories or biggest awards like Game of the Year, it did still have a good night in its own right.
Yeah. And I'd like to note that even though it wasn't really a big winner or anything, it is cool to see a game like Undertale mentioned in a couple of categories here in a big major industry event. Like, bearing in mind, Undertale was a one-man undertaking by a guy who's really, like, I think he's only like 21 years old, 21, 22. He basically just put this game together by himself over the course of however many months or whatever, wrote the soundtrack himself, wrote all the dialogue, made most of the character sprites and everything. And yeah, it sort of became this phenomenon that just sort of took off. And it's really cool that something like that can just happen.
It is. And not only was Undertale, as we said, nominated for Outstanding Achievement in Game Direction, but it also was nominated in the category of Best RPG Massively Multiplayer Game, ultimately losing out to Fallout 4.
Yeah, but it was going up against Fallout 4 and The Witcher 3.
And Bloodborne.
Yes, and Bloodborne. Like, if I was Toby Fox, I would be like just happy that I was mentioned in the same breath as these games.
Those are massive AAA titles with multi-million dollar development budgets.
Oh yeah.
Huge teams.
Yeah.
Working on it.
And your quirky little Earthbound type game is recognized right along them. That's really cool.
You've done well. Frame those nominations, whatever pieces of paper you have, you know, saying, hey, you and your game have been nominated in this category, this category, this category. Put it on the wall. That is an accomplishment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, even if you only want to do game development for a little bit, your little bit was way better than most people's little bit.
Oh, God, yes.
Like, that's awesome. So, yeah. Just a little thing I figured would be worth mentioning.
It certainly is. And again, anytime we can toot the horn of Toby Fox and Undertale for his accomplishment, really, in producing what he was able to produce, I think it's certainly something we will do.
Yeah.
And just like we will always end off the show with a segment that we like to call The Blast from the Past.
Indeed.
Which is the segment of the show where we like to take a moment before we get on out of your hair, or more correctly, your ears. At least we hope we are in your ears. If we're anywhere else, don't tell us.
Yes. I apologize if it's by mistake.
That's between you and your God.
Yes.
But the part of the program where we like to remind you of something from yesteryear that you might have forgotten about, something that you might not have heard of, something you may have seen, but not for a while. And it's a piece of entertainment or two pieces of entertainment that maybe even collecting dust on your shelf. But as we get on out of here, just something to remind you of to say, hey, you know what, if you have time this weekend, go revisit these things. So we have two things to remind you of. One, a movie. One, a TV series. One is 30 years old. The other is 20 years old. Where shall we start?
We might as well talk about the TV show first.
All right. This TV series made its debut on September 18th, 1993 and ran until 20 years ago, ultimately ending on February 24th, 1996. And this was very much from the era of 90s action cartoons, with the series and characters being focused on anthropomorphized animals.
Yes, directly a reaction to the Ninja Turtles. There were a number of shows that were a direct reaction to the Ninja Turtles. Too many for me to remember. There were tons of them. I mean,
Street Sharks?
Yeah, Street Sharks is the first one that comes to mind. You know, like a number of ones, but this was probably the other notable one that I remember.
Or Bucky O'Hare.
Bucky O'Hare, yeah, I guess was another notable one. But this one, for some reason, I always thought as like the second in line in terms of quality behind the Ninja Turtles when I was a kid. Even though, looking back at it as an adult, it's a direct ripoff of Ninja Turtles. Right from the first episode, one of the characters looks at the camera and goes, what? What were you expecting? Turtles? And it basically like winks. And you're like, oh, come on. But that show, of course, was Biker Mice from Mars.
The show that, just like Turtles, told you everything you needed to know about the series right in the title of the series.
Yes. So, while Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles were Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the Biker Mice from Mars were Biker Mice from Mars.
Because 90s cartoons. That's just how it worked.
Brilliant. It's like, well, don't have to worry about a weird drawn-out origin story. We got it covered in the title.
And if the title didn't give it away, the theme music did.
Yes, of course. But
it told you the entire synopsis right there. And then the character designs gave it away because they look like humanoid mice, but with red antennae. Because they're aliens.
Yeah, they're aliens.
From Mars.
But they're dressed like Earth bikers, you know, wearing like leather jackets and wearing sunglasses and stuff and riding, you know, Harley Davidson style motorcycles.
But amped up, you know, with more attitude and edge.
Yeah, because it was the 90s, you know, like the big crazy choppers and like the outrageous exhaust pipes and the, like the seat that went way too high or whatever. You know what I'm talking about, the kind of angular motorcycle that you'd only see in 90s cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they all drove those.
Just kind of amped up with, you know, more weaponry with, it's like someone stood over the artist's shoulder and said, oh, can we increase the edge by 20%? needs more attitude. Can we increase the attitude by 8%? All right, let's try it maybe at 5% only. Okay. And that's what they did. And the series focuses on three mice. I don't recall if they're brothers or whatnot. Throttle, Moto, and someone else whose name I'm...
Vinny.
Vinny, thank you. A brown mouse, a white mouse, and a gray mouse who wore an eye patch.
Yep. And they were backed up by Charlene Charlie Davidson, who is their mechanic friend.
I feel like that's a reference to something. I just don't know what.
She, according to the Wikipedia page here, the mice were always backed up by Charlie, a human mechanic who owns the Last Chance Garage in Chicago. She's a headstrong woman and is always ready to go into battle, though the biker mice try to keep her out of dangerous situations, never because they think she's incapable or weak, but because they couldn't bear anything bad happening to her. So she was essentially their April O'Neil.
She was, and they were in Chicago instead of New York City.
Yeah, and they, of course, had their their ridiculous range of villains, cartoon villains to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So their big bad was Lawrence Limburger, who was a rat, a big anthropomorphic rat, instead of the mice.
Who was disguised in, like, had a human form, and essentially he was kind of like the Luton plunder character or villain off Captain Planet.
Yes.
He was just there to rob all of Earth's resources. He himself was a Martian who, like, had destroyed Mars and had come to Earth to destroy Earth, and the mice followed him.
Yeah. Some silly, just cartoon plot line that doesn't really make a lot of sense. But other characters.
But go with it.
Yeah, other characters. Actually, interestingly enough, one of the other characters who was a bad guy was called Grease Pit, and he was voiced by Brad Garrett, surprisingly. You know, from Everybody Loves Raymond, the big, tall, monotone brother.
Mm-hmm. Oh, probably because they needed a deep-voiced character.
And also, they needed, like, you know, the teen heartthrob appeal, so they got Luke Perry to voice Napoleon Bree.
Well, that's an interesting thing about Biker Mice from Mars is it had several connections to Beverly Hills 90210. Brian Austin Green was a voice on the show.
Yep.
And Ian Ziering, before he was a voice on the Mighty Ducks cartoon, he was a voice on Biker Mice from Mars.
Yes, he played Vinny, who was the self-proclaimed lady killer who had white fur.
Good for him.
Good for him, yeah.
I remember I think it was Throttle, the big gray mouse with the eye patch.
Yeah, he was the leader guy.
I remember him most distinctly because I had the toys, because obviously I had the toys. And his character, I think it was his right arm, was like a robot arm, and he had a panel in his forearm that would open up and had like lasers or some sort of weaponry in there.
Yeah, because this was, you know, the futuristic technology that is found only on Mars.
Naturally, and they've brought it to Earth with them. And not only did they live in Chicago, but their secret lair was inside the scoreboard at Wrigley Field. Cause no one's ever gone in there.
Yeah, no one will think to look there.
Like, at least with the turtles, they're in the sewers, and people don't really go into the sewers.
Yeah, I mean, other than, like, city maintenance workers, but they're not in the main sewer lines. It's clearly established that they've found some sewer that's, like, not often used and clearly doesn't need maintenance very often. Mm-hmm.
So, some unserviced area that they can just hide. It's abandoned. Cool. Wrigley Field is used for, like, 6 months of the year.
Yes, it's almost, you know, gonna see what, like 20,000 people almost daily for a period of time?
Yes, and not only that, it's just right there.
And the scoreboard is used pretty much every single baseball game. unless I'm mistaken about how baseball games are run.
Unless something bad has happened and just the scoreboard's out of commission, yeah, it's gonna be used for 80 some odd games in a season. So, yes? Cartoon logic? I'm gonna go with cartoon logic, but.
Yeah, they tried to bring the show back in 2006, but it only lasted a few episodes. I think 28 episodes or something, but.
Yeah, even that just seems a bit much.
Yeah, a bit too much considering the original run was 65 episodes of over three seasons. So, yeah, but I don't know, it's worth a watch. If not a whole episode, then maybe just a couple scenes on YouTube, just to kind of like remind yourself that yes, the anthropomorphic animal, you know, with a weird, the anthropomorphic animal group with a strange catchy name thing was a fad that lasted for a good 3-4 years in the early 90s.
It certainly did. And as we said, other shows out of that era that you could very well watch clips of on YouTube as you're going down this rabbit hole.
Yes.
I don't feel good about saying that, but again, Street Sharks, Bucky O'Hare, Cowboys of Moo Mesa, the Battletoads cartoon.
Yeah.
Cadillacs and Dinosaurs.
Oh god.
Extreme Dinosaurs. Of course Turtles. But just, or even the Mighty Ducks cartoon.
Yeah. Big Bad Beetleborgs. That wasn't really a cartoon.
No, that was more a ripoff of Power Rangers.
Yeah,
Along with Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad, which the less said about that, the better.
They were about the same era as well, but they were a different thing that was ripping off a different thing. But
that seemed to be a trend in the 90s.
Yes. One thing gets popular, so let's just make a bunch of shows that rip off that one thing and try to and be as popular.
And have no shame about ripping it off either.
Yeah, absolutely no shame. I mean, it was the first episode of Biker Mice from Mars where the one mice, I don't remember which mouse it was.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. He, like, their April O'Neil character said something like, "Oh, you big talking mice." And he was just like, "What were you expecting? Turtles?" It's like, that is the most shameless thing I've ever seen. It's like, as if it wasn't obvious enough that you're ripping off the Ninja Turtles, you're admitting it. This would be evidence in a court of law. Like, that's almost enough for a cease and desist, I think.
But they're mice, so...
clearly different animals.
Exactly. Doesn't count. There was also a tie-in video game on the Super Nintendo based on the classic 90s cartoon as well. It was a top-down, from what I understand, top-down driving game where you control the biker mice as they're going through the streets of Chicago on their motorcycles.
I want to say I've played it, and I want to say I remember it not being very good.
I want to say I'm not surprised.
Yeah. It's, yeah. Actually, the more I think about it, I think it was just a ripoff of Rock and Roll Racing. That's what I think it was, but I could be wrong, but,
that would not surprise me in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah. Basically, we're not suggesting you play the video game. I would suggest you just play Rock and Roll Racing instead. It's way better. But yeah, Biker Mice from Mars, very interesting curiosity from the early 90s.
It is.
If we go back 10 years to the mid 80s.
About just mid 80s.
Sure, mid 80s. Makes more sense.
Because early mid 80s is just the 80s.
Yeah, it's just the 80s. So
you're combining enough time periods
yes.
in there.
Mid-80s, John Hughes was a guy that was sort of like one of the kings of 80s cinema in many ways.
He could do no wrong.
Yeah, 80s, going into even in the early 90s, but in the 80s, he really sort of like hit his stride. He had a number of different movies that his name was attached to, either as in the capacity of a writer, producer, or director. But as a writer, he was pretty prolific. He had a number of different films that he wrote, even if he didn't direct them all, he wrote a hell of a lot of them.
He sure did. And he was most notable in the 80s for working with, quite often the same group of actors in many of his films.
Yeah, like Molly Ringwald made a number of appearances. I want to say John Cryer made a few appearances.
I believe he did.
Harry Dean Stanton as well.
James Spader might have, but also Ali Sheedy was in a couple movies.
Yeah.
Emilio Estevez. And just a number of them, and they became termed the Brat Pack back in the 80s. I believe Robert Downey Jr. was in that group as well, Demi Moore.
Yeah, a number of them.
Been lumped into that category as well. And we're talking about this John Hughes movie, which came out from his heyday of writing, directing, producing, being involved in great 80s teen movies.
Yeah, though this one wasn't directed nor produced by him. This one was definitely written by him, though. This was Pretty in Pink,
which came out on February 28th of 1986. That's Molly Ringwald as the star, with John Cryer as her best friend in high school.
Ducky,
yes. Going through high school life.
Yes. Yeah, full disclosure, I've never seen this movie. I've seen a lot of John Hughes movies, but I've never seen this one.
I've seen parts on TV, but
I've seen lots of things parody this movie. I mean, Family Guy did a whole parody of it as well. I remember seeing that. Yeah. I have nothing to say about this movie other than it's a movie that I've seen lots of people talk about mm-hmm. all the time in terms of like John Hughes stuff and 80s classic, but to be honest, I was never really that interested in it. I don't know why. I'm a cold, heartless monster, I guess.
Oh, is that all?
Yes.
Oh, well, you just said it so casually that, all right, I guess you're comfortable enough with yourself to admit it. I'm just going to accept it. I've seen parts of it on television, say when it's running on TBS or what have you, but, or on Movie Time, any of the movie channels, but never sat down to watch the full thing. Often because I pick it up in the middle and figure out, well, I've missed a good portion of it already. I do know it's set in high school, and a bit more of an accurate take on high school life than what we would often otherwise see in other movies depicting American high school life. It's the language is more realistic, the scenarios are a bit more realistic, and that was kind of the important thing with John Hughes in his movies, is that he didn't play down, he didn't pander, he didn't take liberties necessarily with the representation of teenagers and teenage life.
And he definitely spoke the language of the people, you know, of the time. Of course, you'd look back at some of his movies. I mean, I can only really speak to the ones I've seen, mm-hmm. which is still a fair amount of John Hughes movies. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I like John Hughes. But, you know, for some reason, I just never saw this movie. And I really have no excuse. I don't know why. But, yeah, I mean, like, he always just kind of used slang of the day, even if, like, it doesn't age as well as, you know, from a language standpoint. He still writes classic scenes and everything, even if, you know, he wouldn't be able to write at all the way he wrote back then. I mean, if I think about, like 16 Candles, for example, there's some pretty not okay, not politically correct things said in that movie that crack me up, because it's like, well, that's just what people were like back then. And we're not really like that anymore, which is okay, but you can't really make as many Polish jokes as he did just in like, just out in the open like that. Like really in a major motion picture, people making Polish jokes, and like every time, like, your stereotype Chinese character's name is mentioned, like a gong sounds? Like, can you really actually do that? Like, whoa. But yeah, I mean, he's still like, there's a certain, like, not being afraid to write how people actually talk that mm-hmm. John Hughes always just was sort of known for, which I definitely always respected.
Mm-hmm. And an honest approach to it that we see not just in Pretty in Pink, but also in Breakfast Club as well.
Oh, yeah. Another movie that has sort of like most of his actors that he worked with a bunch in.
Yeah, it's true. And also, if you want something, you know, some lighter John Hughes fare, Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Uncle Buck,
yes. Also
Home Alone.
Also wrote Home Alone 1 and 2.
Yep.
And even Beethoven, I think.
Could be.
I think that may have been uncredited, may have been under an alias, but I think as we got into the 90s, there was less and less demand for John Hughes' work. Not to say that people didn't want it, but he may not have been as in touch with the youth or that generation in the 90s, in that moment of the 90s, as say he was in the 80s.
It was actually written, Beethoven, I'd like to say, was written by John Hughes under the pseudonym of Edmond Dantes.
Ooh.
Which is a character in The Count of Monte Cristo. But all that aside, yes, John Hughes definitely had a number of classic movies. You could be, I would say just take your pick and watch a classic John Hughes movie.
True.
Maybe I should eventually watch Pretty in Pink, I guess.
If someone's forcing you to, then all right, capitulate and just go with it. But for those of you out there who've already seen it and wish to go back and watch it again, you can do so to celebrate its 30th anniversary this weekend because it came out on February 28th of 1986. Or if you're of a slightly younger generation than those who would remember watching Pretty in Pink when it first came out, then you might want to check out and enjoy Biker Mice from Mars for some early 90s animated goodness, just to see what the action cartoons were like in that day. And
yes,
you know, perhaps get sucked into buying toys, just going on an eBay jag afterwards and just buying all the Biker Mice from Mars toys.
Just make sure you're not too drunk while doing it, because that's a good way to lose a lot of money.
And how? Take it from me. I know. That was a dark couple of years.
Yes, the eBay addiction was strong with Mike the Legend, but man, and with a couple of other friends I know.
But man, when the stuff comes in the mail, you've totally forgotten you've bought it. So it's like Christmas.
It's like Christmas, except only a little bit more regret.
And then you feel bad, so you drink the pain away, but then it starts all over again, so it's a vicious cycle.
Yes.
But this show is certainly not a vicious cycle, and certainly our time is up for this week's edition of The Arcade, and we thank you so much for joining us. And as always, before we get on out of here, we want to let you know that you can always get in touch with us through the power of email, if that's still a thing. People sit down to compose full emails with properly written sentences, paragraphs, multiple paragraphs even.
Actually, if you want to even just apply the rules of Twitter to emails, that's fine too. There's nothing stopping you.
That is true.
There's actually no character limit though, so you can go over the 140s characters if you want. You don't have to send several emails that are just small sentences. You can actually send all of your thoughts in one. It's really amazing.
If you wish to try that, our email address is info@thearcadeshow.com, or you can also use the contact us form on our website, thearcadeshow.com. Or if you don't enjoy the email approach, we also do have Twitter. We are @TheArcadeShow. Give us a follow. And also on Facebook, like our page, facebook.com/TheArcadeShow. So if you can be okay with the email, not email thing, we're okay with whatever works for you. We're open to many things. We'll accept your communications in any way, shape, or form. And we appreciate everything you send our way, except burning bags of poop.
Yes, we don't want those.
Leave those on your neighbor's doorstep.
Yes. As long as neither of us is your neighbor, that's fine.
Yeah, I guess we really should qualify that, shouldn't we?
Yes. Basically, don't do that to either of us.
Anyone else?
Anyone else? I don't care.
Fair game.
Yes.
So until next week, everybody, good night.
Good night.